So this is David Swanson, and I'm speaking with David Siegel, candidate for Congress from Rhode Island, and someone I think that political progressives from around the country might want to be taking an interest in. David, thanks for speaking with me.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for saying all those nice things.
Well, I wonder if you could say from your own point of view, what's your background that brings you to this, and why you think people outside of Rhode Island might want to be paying a little attention?
I was a city councilman in Providence, first elected as a Green in 2002, and had been in the state legislature since 2006 as a Democrat. And if you want to talk about why I decided to make that transition from one party to another, I'm happy to in more detail. But my work throughout those 8 years has entailed pushing back against powerful, typically wealthy, corporatist interests, against leadership within my own party, now as a Democrat, against the powers that be in Providence to try to do right by working families in Providence, in Rhode Island, to try to push back against the standard fare corporatist interests that run the country and also run the state and also run the city. And that work's happened on basically every issue front that a progressive might care about.
I know a couple of areas that you've been involved with. One is proposing to cease funding our wars overseas. Should you be elected to Congress, I set up a list called a Coalition Against War Spending at CAWS.US, and you or your campaign immediately signed you on there with many other candidates. But many of them are Greens, many of them are Libertarians, and many are Democrats. What is your thinking in being willing to say you'll stop voting to fund the wars? Because as you know, great many members of Congress are willing to say they oppose the wars and they're critics of the wars, but will not come within many miles of saying I won't fund the wars.
Right. Well, I'll start by saying I'm a vegetarian and wouldn't hurt a fly. I've been against the wars since before they began. I was my first act on the city council in Providence was to sponsor an anti-war resolution in 2003 through the Cities for Peace program, which was obviously not a it was not going to end the war or prevent the war in its own right, but it was a necessary step between here and there to have cities assert that the war was clearly going to have negative impacts on cities and their ability to function and fund municipal services and education and so on. And it has, of course, had all of those effects. So my first act as a council member was to oppose the war in Iraq. And I represent the area around Brown and RISD and helped restart anti-war mobilization on campus, which was waning during the sort of 2003-2004 era where there was this awful Washington consensus that the war was okay and the war was going kind of well, even, and left activists were demoralized. We restarted the chapter here, and I've helped organize and spoken at countless rallies about the war. At the state level, I've been the sponsor of the Bring the Guard Home legislation that's been pushed by Ben Mansky and Liberty Tree, which asserts essentially that the mandate under which the Guard was federalized has expired. The Guard was federalized in order to neutralize the threat that Saddam Hussein posed and to enforce the existing UN resolutions at the time of 2003, and that all of that has been accomplished, or at least is no longer on the table, and that therefore the Guard is improperly federalized and should be brought home. And if the legislation passes, it compels the Attorney General of the given state to sue the federal government on those grounds. No such bill has passed yet, but we're trying, and I've been at the helm of the Rhode Island node, though we have a very right-wing governor, and so would not but withstand his veto here. And I think that war is a horror for a thousand different reasons that your your listeners and your readers understand through and through. And the thing that was most striking to me, back in 2003 when we were doing opportunity cost calculations about what it would cost to spend, when we thought it was only going to be $100 billion to fund the war in Iraq. What does that mean? What is that worth to the world? And the most striking stat that I remember from back then was that it would provide enough funds to pay for vaccinations relative to every disease for which humanity has developed a vaccination for every child born for the next 75 years. And instead of doing that, and it's a little bit of a false choice, that was not something our government was going to do, but I think it's always imperative to talk about the opportunity costs of war, and there are opportunity costs that might more readily have been met, education funding domestically, in public infrastructure funding domestically and so on. But that contrast was just so stark to me. 75 years worth of children vaccinated relative to every disease for which humans have developed vaccinations versus going into a purposeless war in Iraq in which hundreds of thousands of people or millions of people would be killed.
It's a stunning comparison. I want to ask you about some other topics if you have time, but I want to ask one quick follow-up on this one, which is, a lot of people run for Congress as opponents of war, and then they get in there, and the leader of their party tells them, we'll give you $1 million for television ads in your re-election campaign in 2 years if you do whatever we tell you. And so then what they tell the public is, well, I want to vote no on this war money, but I need to wait and see what good things are packaged in there with it. And then, of course, the leadership packages lots of good things, jobs and schools and civil rights in with the war money. And then the voting goes down based on permission from the leadership to, you can vote against the war as long as we're sure the war is going to pass. It sounds to me like you're making a more solid commitment than that.
Yes, I am. And in Rhode Island, I've tried to develop alternative structures for legislators to lean on when the leadership makes such threats. I am the lead organizer for our Progressive Caucus. I founded a political action committee to support members of our Progressive Caucus so that if funding from sources dries out that leadership's request because something was done to offend them, that we would have at least some degree of money to fall back on to help fund our campaigns, nonetheless. And we fund 10, 12 races relatively modestly, but in the last cycle, and hopefully we'll be able to do something in the forthcoming cycle. And I've also helped organize my colleagues to stand up to leadership relative to budgetary issues in particular, and we stood as a block to prevent the defunding of municipal services during supplemental budget a year ago, and it was the progressives negotiating hard with the leadership while the bell calling us into session to come in and take the vote was ringing for 2 hours and compelled them to restore tens of millions of dollars, to $25 million, which in Rhode Island is a big amount of money, to municipal services and to education funding that, if not restored, would have compelled progressive property tax increases and cuts to critical services for our constituents. So I'm an organizer at heart, and I don't go into this naively and think that as a freshman legislator at the federal level, you can just go around and wrangle all of your longer-standing colleagues and get them to do something differently than they've done before. But my goal, if I get elected, is to be an organizer and to help build solidarities among members and help strengthen the Progressive Caucus so that it can stand stronger up against leadership when it comes to war funding, when it comes to health care, and so on.
Well, as you're no doubt painfully aware, it never stands at all. So that would be wonderful, and I agree you would have a fight as a freshman, but to be there trying to organize the Progressive Caucus to take stands would be phenomenal. The other topic I definitely wanted to ask you about was something else that you've done at the state level that relates to the national, and that is, my understanding, you're the only state legislator in any state who's gone in response to this Citizens United ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court allowing unlimited corporate money in elections, and said not just that our state should formally urge Congress to amend the Constitution, but that the state of Rhode Island should call for a constitutional convention, and when we get to 2/3 of the states, I believe it is, calling for such a convention, then we'll hold a convention whether Congress likes it or not. Can you tell me why you took that approach?
Sure. I've been working closely with Change Congress and with Larry Lessig and other reformers on that measure. I mean, I think, again, that your listeners and your readers need no explanation of why it's a travesty now that corporations can expend as much as they care to affect our elections and their outcomes. And Congress is loath to act to change this for a variety of reasons that are probably pretty obvious and need not be spelled out. And when you're dealing with a structure that is itself whose own perpetuation is contingent upon particular structures. When you're dealing with an entity like Congress whose ability to perpetuate itself is contingent upon these financing structures, it necessarily requires an outside force to come in and say, no, we need to change these structures because any organization is going to do what it can to perpetuate its own well-being. And the Constitution allows for 2/3 of the states to call for a federal constitutional convention. No such convention has ever actually happened, but just the act of organizing towards one can compel Congress to do the right thing, in particular relative to the 17th Amendment, the amendment that says that senators must be elected by the people as opposed to state legislatures, was only put forth by Congress when 2/3 of the states minus one had called for a constitutional convention to address precisely that issue. So even if we don't get to the convention proper, the act of agitating for it is something that can compel Congress to do the right thing. And it's become evident over the course of the cycle that Congress is not going to act on its own in a meaningful way to address the Citizens United decision. I mean, they're pushing the Disclose Act right now, which is somewhere between here and there, but nobody's got the sense that Congress is actually going to put forth an amendment to the several states for ratification that would fundamentally assert that, in fact, the First Amendment does not allow for corporations to spend as they care to in our elections. And so a constitutional convention and outside intervention is necessary.
That being said, and I enthusiastically agree with all of it, would you be inclined to sign on to Congresswoman Donna Edwards' amendment in Congress?
Of course.
because there are a handful of Congress members trying against all odds. So,
yeah. There's some who deserve credit for it, but it's just clear that leadership's not going to let it happen. And we can help them in their efforts by agitating as such from the outside, and all of those reasonable Washington consensus types will swoop in if we get to the point where enough states are supporting a con and say, okay, don't worry, guys, actually we'll deal with this on our own and do right by us, out of fear that if they do not, a constitutional convention would actually happen.
You know, I not only want better people, candidates like yourself in Congress, but I want Congress to have more power, because just about all power has moved to the White House as well as to the two parties. And if I could ask you about one other area, if you have time, a lot of us worked very hard to try to impeach Bush and Cheney and said if we don't, then the presidents are going to have even more powers. And of course, the president does now have even more powers, but he's a president from the other party. And so, just as the Republicans never engaged in any oversight with Bush, and the Democrats very little themselves. Now the Democrats are not engaging in any oversight with Obama, and aside from Joe Lieberman, nobody has subpoenaed anybody for a year and a half. Nobody has proposed to impeach anybody for a year and a half, and you have committee hearings on lawyers who've put forth memos on who you can torture and how, people like John Yoo and Jay Bybee, without John Yoo or Jay Bybee be there because you can no longer ask anyone to show up for a hearing. I'm wondering what your position is on the powers of Congress and Congress's long forgotten powers to use its own police force to compel people to attend, to hold people in contempt itself and fine them as they refuse to testify, and otherwise assert its presence in Washington as the first branch in our Constitution,
and as the most democratic branch.
If you saw someone like Jay Bybee, who authored memos authorizing not just torture but aggressive war at presidents' whims, sitting there as a lifetime judge, would you consider the possibility of submitting articles of impeachment for someone like that?
Yeah, of course. Yes, of course. I think that Congress should make broader use of its oversight power. Something that I wish had happened here in my home state of Rhode Island more readily. There's no reason to tolerate the abuses of power that have defined the Bush administration. And I would have signed on to efforts by Dennis and by others, by you and your organization, to try to compel testimony under oath and to compel impeachment where proper.
So what can people do to help you? When's your primary? What are you up against? And how can people help?
It's a September 14th primary four-way race. Clearly winnable. We have a really robust field after we had our first statewide canvass on Saturday and had more than 50 volunteers out. First district-wide canvass, I should have said, had more than 50 volunteers out throughout the district. And we'll be doing a regular rhythm of such canvasses throughout the campaign. And the field is really going to be the lifeblood of this effort, as it's been for my elections to the state house and to the city council. But we still need money to help fuel those efforts. We need to pay for literature. We need to pay for food and water for our volunteers. We need to ideally accrue enough funding to go up on TV and compete in that venue as well. So people can donate at Eagle for Congress. And we've raised $100,000+ in the first few weeks of our campaign in small increments, and want to raise money in a democratic way and want to win this election in a democratic way through a genuinely grassroots effort. So even a modest donation of $5, $10 would be incredibly helpful.
Terrific. I will let everyone know that I can. I think the House of Representatives is where we're going to get any control if we are in Washington, and having people there willing to take a stand, even if they're not from our own district, is what's going to make a difference. Anything else we should know?
No, I mean, thanks so much for speaking with me, and contact info up on the website if anybody has a more detailed question. I've written about 1,000 articles over the year for Huffington Post and for more mainstream papers, for Common Dreams and Truth Out and so on. And there's a lot of info out there, but if people have questions, they should feel free to get in touch with me or with the campaign directly.
Wonderful. David Siegel, S-E-G-A-L, Siegel, siegelforcongress.com or votesiegel.com. Thanks for speaking with me.
Yeah, thanks so much, David.